we are trying to make it for critical business applications also, we would prefer at least two or three different audits, preferably. Second part would be like even launching our tokens on any exchange basically will cost us money.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 20th episode of Colors of Web3 and Entrepreneurship. My name is Lum, your typical Web3 host. And here we are today, back to the Web3 world again. I'm today with Abhijit Sinha, who is the CEO and founder of Decimo. Abhijit, can you give us a quick introduction about yourself?
Hello, thanks for joining, for inviting me. From my background side, I have around 19, 20 years of experience in IT segment, where I started as a developer. I moved up across the hierarchy in the corporate sector where I worked for multiple national companies, MNCs from Infosys, Cognizant, TCS and all. In terms of rising from the ranks of being a developer into a business analyst and then a growth officer. During the phases, I have left most of my life across the world. Most of my time I spent in US, Europe, Middle East, APAC region. And during the 20 time frame where I actually went to do my studies in Madrid, Spain, and that is was a turning point where I got introduced to blockchain as a technology, and much more beyond the technology, right? As in, it was introduced to me as a different mindset and how to do a different way of doing business. With that approach, there were an array of different use cases and potentials of this particular technology and the new way of working that came out. So from that point onwards, I basically pivoted the entire story and have been working actively as a blockchain evangelist. And I held after that the role of the head of blockchain in sales and pre-sale solutioning in Wipro for over 4 or 5 years. After which I went on to work as a VP in a very boutique called Decafor based out of Dubai. And during these phases, I got exposed to a lot, not only exposed, but I also implemented and executed a lot of large scale blockchain projects. Some of them were on the corporate side in terms of having permissioned blockchains like Hyperledger, Quorum, Coda and such, and building use cases for corporates. Then during that phases, we also saw huge traction in terms of blockchain adoption on the public space or permissionless space, where Ethereum and many, many other protocols started to come up with their own unique offerings. And that basically tilted my focus from permission blockchain to more permissionless and open platform, public platforms. And what can be done through that. So over the past 2 years, I've been working in the space of public blockchains, building utilities, protocols, and advising customers, doing a lot of consulting exercises and helping them build their use cases around it. Now, over this tenure of around 19 years, I have, as I said, multiple roles, but my specialization was always around new product development, either through like a new product in-house development, or it was through a mergers and acquisitions. So that was where my specialization was coming in from. And with that strong focus towards building new products, I came into the space where I felt there was a huge gap in terms of adoption of blockchain, or rather say Web3, which is a much bigger area of technology beyond just blockchain, in terms of what can be brought together, how can it be made more accessible, more usable for the masses. So with that agenda in mind, close to last year, April onwards, that's where this particular idea started coming up, where we have this thing, right, that in Web3 space, the trends are so dynamic that they come on almost a daily basis or a weekly basis. And they just rise up, shoots up very fast, and then maybe it doesn't sustain. That's fair enough. But yeah, some of the very, very interesting things do turn out from those trends as well. So what I observed was like there are a lot of opportunities to be grabbed around there, and how can people quickly leverage them, right? Basically, when that trend is on the upscale, how do we actually leverage it and make it available for the people. So with that thought processes, we built this company called Decimal. It was, as I said, we have been working on this from April last year, but last year, August was when we actually registered the company. And from that point onwards, we have been working to build the MVP and get it. So if I have to explain what the company is about, in short, it is basically an intent execution platform. Now, intent is anything that you desire to get executed on a platform. Now, to give a certain example, you can come to me and say, like, I need a certain data from certain exchange. Fair enough. I can get it to you. Now, if you want a certain computation to be done specifically, very, very specific for your requirement, because your requirement might still be the same thing like BTC versus USD, say, for example, a price key, but you might require it from five different sources. You have a comma separated and in the output format. Now, this is a very simple example that I'm giving out, but again, the very next guy to you, even though he's asking for the same thing like BTC versus USD price, but he might require it as a space separated format. He might need it to be a weighted average rather than a regular average. He might require from a very different sources. He might require a different quorum. Now, this is a very, very simple example that I'm giving. Like, everyone's requirement is very unique. So if you come and tell us, like, okay, what exactly is your requirement? We are very flexible in terms of getting it executed in a decentralized manner. And so basically this becomes a multiple fold, right? If we talk about bringing the data from off-chain world, real world chain world onto on-chain, it becomes an oracle. So we can build very customizable mini oracles for you. If you are looking for, say, for example, a data that is already available in any other chain and bring it over to your chain and be able to use it in your DApp, for example, that becomes a bridge. Again, that is something very feasible. Now, we can also talk about different other use cases around, like, you might require this on a periodic basis, like you need it every 5 seconds or 10 seconds or 1 minute, 1 hour, right? So your requirement again can vary there. Or you can have it very asynchronous, like, okay, something happens somewhere, some random trigger happens, and that should trigger your output, right? That if it rains, say, for example, in Japan, you need to know what will be the price of a particular retail good in India, right? Because there might be some synergies there. So you can decide upon what is the trigger factor for your events and build anything of your desire. So with that said, we tried to make it also. So now this was the core idea about usability. We went one step ahead beyond that in terms of building it in the format, like, not only making it accessible and usable, but security is one very hard part of, intrinsic part of it. So we are basically using TEEs, or Trusted Executable Environments, or other name for them is enclaves, which are secure environments. Yeah.
Let me stop you there for a moment. So before we dive into a lot of the technical details about your protocol, actually would like to maybe give a little bit more background about your professional background and how you got into Web3.
Sorry,
Can you share with us about how you got into Web3 in the first place? Was that during your time in Spain when you were living abroad there? Was that your first encounter? And how did it come about? And what did you do at that time?
So I was doing my MBA from IE Business School out of Madrid. And two of my colleagues who were studying with me, they have been doing the Bitcoin. They have been involved in Bitcoin from 2012, I believe. And they had held Bitcoins when it was worth like six.
Wow. So they must be the original gangster, as they call it. Yeah.
So $6 to, like, even at that time, they suggested, like, okay, we need to buy and all in 2016 also. Of course, I missed that opportunity at this point of time. But yeah, they basically helped me understand that it is not just the technology itself, right? It's basically reversing the whole structure of how you manage the data, who controls the data. So basically, it became from corporates or middlemen actually deciding upon any of the transaction And basically, at the earlier, the phase of life was basically about data hoarding. Everyone calls like data is the oil of the future, right? So that is where everyone was trying to hoard the data. But blockchain came and said that the way that it can actually be replicated was, it was more about co-opetition. Like, you can be a competitor, but even if we cooperate with each other and be true about our transactions, we do not try to cheat each other, we both will win. So it basically prevented things like collusions or monopolies or oligopolies. Instead of that, it was making it much more widespread and more. So that approach of towards doing anything made a lot more sense to me. So that is how I got introduced. Again, there was a very, very good example that they gave, as in, like, if they are basically, if I want to have a picnic, say, for example, I want to plan a picnic with you. Now, it is very easy to do because it is just two of us. But if I get third person, fourth person, 100th person, 200th person to be involved in that picnic, that adds to the chaos and it makes it much more difficult to manage. Whereas the beauty of blockchain is, if it is actually two of us, there's a higher chances, a higher probability of actually failure, because it is you versus me. It is not collaborative. As more and more people come into play, as more democracy, our synergies are established, it makes it much more easier, much more secure, and much more useful to use the technology. So in those scenarios, it actually made a lot more sense. Like, if I am able to just trust someone without having to revalidate what they have said, it will save a lot of cost, lot of effort, lot of friction in doing business, where a lot of money is spent, lot of costs are incurred. So if you are able to reduce all of those parts, that's basically where we saw a lot of value for blockchain. It was not, and it was never introduced to me as a thing that will overwrite, replace a technology. It is never supposed to be a replacement of any other technology. It is supposed to be a complementary technology. It is always supposed to enhance the way that we are right now doing to something better. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that is how I learned the technology. There was one more, if you don't mind, I'll add one more part to it. Is something that I learned during my tenure in Wipro, was where there was a term that was coined called as, like, you must be aware of this, all these softwares which are enterprise resource planning, right? ERPs, yeah. Tools, right?
Yeah, very familiar, yeah.
So blockchain is supposed to be a network resource planning. You can manage resources, not... So enterprise resource planning is just within your organization. You can, because you have control over it, you can manage all the departments, all the things, all the transactions through that particular single point of thing. But if you are interacting with a third party, like a vendor, supplier, customer, go crazy. How do you manage them? So that's where blockchain used to come in. Like, if you are able to make it as a network resource planning tool, then everyone wins. Everyone knows what is happening. Everyone knows what to expect, where to trust, what not to trust, what went wrong, who's responsible. So all of those things become very, very transparent and much easier to manage. So that was another way of that I was introduced to blockchain, where not to consider that as a technology, but also a collaborative tool, and not to take it as a, like, you replace anything versus that.
I like that. Yeah, I like how when you look at it that way, right, then it's blockchain and Web3 is like new technology that come in not to disrupt. I mean, it will probably disrupt some industry, but then it will help and support other industry, right? This is like another tool set, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like that, yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Can you share with us what you do for fun outside of work at the moment? What are your hobbies?
Right now, I don't have my dog here with me, but basically, I have a dog farm, which I use.
What does that mean, a dog farm? Like a farm full of dogs, or
a farm?
Oh.
A dog farm where it's kind of a resort which I run, where I basically, it's a big open area where dogs come, play, socialize, exercise, meet new friends, run around. And you imagine me standing in the center of it and just enjoying them, right? So that's my best time pass. And in that manner, I also try to help out a lot of, like, we do a lot of exercises in terms of helping out with adoptions and giving shelters to a lot of abandoned dogs and everything. So that's where I have a very substantial amount of time that I spend there as well. But it helps me relax, so that's why I call it as a hobby. Yeah.
Nice. Oh, it sounds quite fun. Sounds like similar to some of the, you know, cat cafe or dog cafe or whatever other pet cafe concept in Japan and many other countries, right?
Yeah. It's just that that's... there's no cafe as in food concept. It is basically people come for there for boarding, for like they come in the morning during the, and the, so basically it's like a hostel for the dogs, where or basically school for the dogs, where you go drop your kids, go to office. On your way back from office, pick up the kids, go back home.
I see. So they can like put the dog in there and you can take care of it, yeah, for the
exactly
the whole day. Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Oh, sounds like fun. Yeah. Anyway, well, without further ado, yeah, let's go ahead and maybe deep dive into your current company, Decimal. Feel free to share any decks or, you know, lay out any background necessary for the company.
Sure. Thank you. I'm sorry, I kind of covered a lot of part of it. I got actually into the flow of it and then I went
on to it. Yeah, but I figure you were getting a bit too technical too early. So yeah, anyway.
Okay. Go for it. Let me know if you're able to see my screen.
Yes, I can see it, yeah.
Okay. So as I was saying that we are talking about an intent execution platform in a decentralized manner. And in order to make that happen, we have two big components to it in terms of we have made it AI powered. And I'll explain what I mean by AI powered. And then we are securing the entire system through hardware security, which again, I'll explain it. So at the end of the day, so the only word that we are thinking about is basically usability and accessibility, right? So that is basically the underlying theme for the entire company. Like, how do you make things more easy to use and much more accessible for people to have a lot more people come and explore? So what is the space that we are talking about? Again, I'll start with the grandma in the left corner, where we are talking about people who still don't understand technology, right? Even though I personally am part of the technology world, but while I understand technology, I'm not able to code it at this point of time. I'm more in terms of business understanding, business valuation of the technology. So how do such people, which are a very vast majority of people who still don't understand technology, be able to use it, right? And that too, especially Web3, right? Because, and the challenges that are basically, they are too manual, too technical. Like if you are trying to get involved with any entity in Web3, you have to make a request. There are specific code link to be done, and then it has to be deployed, expanded out to the network of people, community has to be built before anything can be done, right? So how do we make these things a lot easier, a lot less time consuming? Even the learning curve are very, very difficult because it involves a lot of custom code, coding, testing, deployment, everything. And one of the biggest thing again is, like, as I said, like it is about the ever-changing trends, right? So with the ever-changing trends, narratives, and new things coming up almost every day, it is very difficult for any layman to basically stay up to date. So what is the problem statement? Now, I've not done a complete analysis of the industry. What I have done is basically I've taken the snapshots of the industry volume from the existing Web3 world itself, right? So we are talking about an almost a $2 trillion worth of just DeFi by 2030, which is rapidly increasing at a 45 CAGR. Now, what does that mean? Basically, people are pouring in on a daily basis into Web3. Money is flowing in. And that's a huge market. And this is only from a DeFi perspective that I'm talking about. It has got nothing to do with non-DeFi projects also, right? So like gaming or any supply chain or retail or any identities, registries. I'm not talking about those at all, right? So this is just a small sample of the market size that we are talking about to just show you what is the potential of things that are coming up. And I've taken the example of DeFi because traditionally, financial world has always been the forerunner of technology, right? Especially in Web3 space and blockchain space. So I've just taken that as a sample example. And to give an example of the market cap of like just three companies that I've taken at 7.1 billion. And this was taken at a bear market, right? Which was like mid of last year. If you are talking about like the bull market that is now coming up, this number just multiplied by 3 or 5 times at the bare minimum. So that is the market potential that we are talking about. So what exactly do we intend to do, right? So we have brought in AI. And what is the role of AI? Is basically you describe what you want. As in like, you can just do a prompt, tell it like, okay, I want this kind of a data. I want it to be sourced from these places. I want this kind of an operation, like a mean, average, addition, subtraction, any kind of operation that you want to do. You describe it. You tell it where you want the data to be reported back to as an output, and what will be the format of that data, and how should it look like. Once you have described that, let AI do the coding for you, right? So, I don't need to explain anyone what is ChatGPT, right? Or what is Midjourney. The one of the biggest benefits of using that kind of a setup is like now people are very used to this kind of a prompt-based systems. They understand how to write codes where we can again further assist. And this actually makes it possible for people to experiment a lot faster, a lot easier. So you open up the doors to a lot of variety of things that can be possibly be made. Once that job is, the AI creates that code, there are very dedicated tooling available with like ChatGPT is a general purpose tool, but there are very specific tools that are dedicatedly for coding, right? And they're really good at it. Now, if we start using this, it makes it a lot easier to build a job, and that we can ensure that it is run in a very, very secured manner. Again, this is since our security, as I said earlier, was a hardware-based security. It doesn't mean that it is a single point of failure because we are making that also decentralized. Like we are making it as an open community-based running. So anyone can run that code. You don't have any predictive mechanism to understand which chip is going to actually execute your code. And that gives you an output.
My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that basically you provide a platform for people to obtain data through chatting with the AI, and the execution will be through a trusted executed environment, right? Basically through hardware, right? Hardware enclave, is that correct?
Not one hardware enclave, a collection of hardware enclaves that are going to be decentralized, yes.
Okay, yeah. So I think there's quite a lot of probably technical terms here. Maybe we can break down a few of them here. Sure. I think first one talk about enclave. What exactly is an enclave? I don't think many people are familiar with that.
Okay. Enclaves or T's means they are used interchangeably. T's basically, I'll just explain the full form of it, is trusted executable environment or trusted execution environment. Now you can think of it like people are in general aware of what is a CPU, right? Or a GPU. So this enclave or TEA is basically a very, very dedicated space on that chip, which is supposed to be a black box where once anything is entered, it cannot be modified in any manner. So once you enter a job, there is no external dependency or there can be no external interference with a job. The chip takes care of that. Once it has executed, say for example, the job has 5 steps. As it is executing these 5 steps, it will keep on giving an attestation as a proof that, yes, this particular step was executed. It was executed as per your requirement, and there was no meddling with it. So we give you computational proofs, like, okay, this A plus B did happen in the way that you asked. And that proof is basically sent out saying that this is the report and this is the proof that, yes, it was executed as per your request. And since everything is happening in that black box, no one is able to go in and manipulate that data or manipulate that processing or computation. So we are preventing any tampering of computation through that particular chipset. So these are dedicated chipsets. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So then who would probably want to tamper with these results or report? Who would potentially
we are talking about, say, for example, bridging or any oracles, right? Basically, I'll take again an example of Oracle is like you are running a very, very sensitive trading application, right? People are relying on you to give them the most accurate Bitcoin versus USD price feed. Because millions and dollars of worth of trading is happening on a minute-by-minute basis based on the data that you're providing, right? Now, say, for example, you ask, come to me and tell me, like, okay, Abhijit or Decimal, please give me this price feed and get it from, say, 20 different exchanges. And do a transaction in the manner that I have minimum like 15 people who are sending the data, you do an average of it and everything. Now, because of this kind of a sensitivity of the data, and the reason why we do this securing the data source from multiple places is to ensure that everything is these are different exchanges or different platforms who hold very minute differences in the pricing, right? Now, whoever is holding a higher price versus lower price, there is a huge chance of arbitrage. Like, people can make millions by just knowing what you are trying to do. And if they also get an access to the computation that you are doing, and they are able to make even a minute change to it, that can lead to huge potential of leakage, like revenue leakage, people crashing the entire exchanges and everything. So the criticality can be very, very severe depending on the kind of a job you are running. Again, I'll tell you another example from a bridging perspective, right? Like, bridging is one of the very sensitive topic because they are the honeypot for hackers, because huge amounts of money is on assets and value is actually flowing from one exchange to another, right? Now, you say I am sending $100 from one side and then you expect like $100 worth of assets on the other side of the chain, right? Or bridge. If I get into the code and I'm able to manipulate it, I can redirect even 5 cents out of it. That can lead to huge potential mismatch of ledgers, right? So there's a huge potential that we have to take care of it in terms of, like, the computations are beyond reproach. Whatever you have asked for should be executed in exactly the same way that you are asking for.
I see. So this product would then, I guess, be geared toward people who are in DeFi, maybe traders, maybe exchanges, or who in particular do you have in mind as the potential customers, users?
So basically, we are starting with there's another slide subsequently. We are given a wide variety of use cases. If you want, I can just quickly skip to that and
go ahead.
Right. So this is the next one. So if I have to give, these are just random scenarios that we have just highlighted to give you an idea about what is possible, right? So the first example is basically capturing off-chain data, that is real world data, into an on-chain data, and then you can build applications on top of it, right? If I bring in the stocks of Apple on a minute by minute basis, maybe you can start trading using cryptos, right? So why not? So basically, there are a lot of use cases there also, right? There are like people like who are looking to build their own artwork and want to keep a track of their work. A person wants to have an asset tokenized. So the asset tokenization is a heavy push, especially after the Bitcoin ETF. There's a huge push towards tokenizing of physical assets and buildings and retail goods, oil, granaries, vegetables. Everything is now starting to get tokenized at a rapid speed. But when you say tokenized, what does it mean? It means that you have a digital representation in the blockchain world. And every with the array of different protocols out there, everyone wants to have that copy of it. Because everyone wants to serve their users in terms of building applications using that data, right? So we can bring that data on board. Now I've gone very random in terms of even being able to verify medical identities, any kind of blacklisting, any kind of potential complaints that impact my thing, credentials. All of those are also kind of getting into blockchain now. If we are able to bring all those registries and information from our real world paper-based information onto blockchain, those can add a lot of array of use cases on top. So it is, as you can see, these are not specifically around DeFi, right? Now, if we are talking about cross-chain interaction, which is basically a bridging solution. Now, bridging solutions, one of the biggest use cases that, again, one of that we are also targeting to cater to is like, if we are able to bring Bitcoin liquidity with the programmability of Ethereum, right? Or EVM chains. So it basically helps bridge that gap. It helps prevent any kind of fragmentation. Like you don't have your money split across the world. You will able to transact by being or initiating your information from one chain, and the corresponding chains are taking care of each other. Like the fees, the gases, everything takes care of itself, and you get the final trading done, right? So you are able to build those kinds of scenarios without always hopping across networks, paying bridging costs, paying gas fees, and then getting to your end network. So instead of doing that, how about be able to manage it from a single place? So those are the second scenarios. Then again, we are talking about metaverse and all the gaming assets that are coming into play. So they want to trade it and they want to get the best deals, auctioning. All of those activities can also happen through that. Now, it doesn't matter which chain you are in, which metaverse you are in, you can still trade across networks. You can buy a Aladdin like a dress in a game and play a FIFA game with it, right? Why not? You have paid hard work, earned cash for it. You should be able to use it across the board. Similarly, if you're talking about real world triggers, it need not be just periodic, right? Things can happen as and when they want, right? So basically, if I want to have a automated fundraising in an event of catastrophe. So if a catastrophe is detected based on certain conditions, the system automatically will trigger an automated fundraising event, right? So how do you get that done? You can use our systems in order to do that. You can set monthly, weekly, hourly, minute by minute salary to people or payouts, which is a huge big bonus as compared to the traditional DeFi, right? You can pay out loans, you can pay out incentives, takings, all of those happens on that same method. So these are some of the things that we are talking about. Again, I gave the last example in terms of like, if there's a political change, political weather, actual weather also for that matter, that changes the any price of a particular commodity, say for example, you should be able to react quickly, right? You need not wait for 5 days to just code and then deploy for another 5 days and then have it trade. By that time, the entire world has moved on, right? So how do you get to capture on trends, how to build long-term strategies, how do you build or basically access real-world data on-chain to build newer applications. So there's a huge array of use cases that we can address. And it is not specifically to say like, okay, we are not talking about developers, but the whole point of using AI is that even people like you, me, my mother can also come and figure it out.
I see. Yeah. So quite a variety of different use cases here, right? So I guess.
So this is just to show the intent. Like it is the whole point of intent is that you can desire what you want. We will get it executed.
Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. Who are the other existing companies in this space?
There are a couple of intent networks that are rapidly coming in. So, like for example, we have one of the big names was Keeper Network. Then Powerpool is another big one that is right now very prominent in the space. Gelato was another one which had a lot of traction, but I think they recently actually changed their narrative to become to specifically focus on roll-ups. So again, there are different companies that are there, but again, this space is rather very nascent yet, because this is something that is technically very difficult with the traditional model. If I have to give an example of why, so basically traditionally the blockchain is supposed to be running using validators, right? And these validators are either whitelisted, like I'm talking about this job executors column. So basically what happens is like these agents or validators are supposed to get whitelisted, or they have to stake some huge amount of money before they can even come on board to verify a particular transaction. And even after they come on board, basically they have a consensus algorithm which says like, okay, they all need to have a majority before they prove a particular transaction is right or wrong, right? So it becomes more of a source system. Now, what we have instead done is like we have eliminated all these agents or this entire consensus mechanism and have replaced it by a team. So the entire ownership of actual execution has gone to the teams or enclaves. So the hardware ensures that no tampering has happened. There is no biasing. There is no unnatural or external motivations towards tampering that particular transaction, right? So you know for a fact that you gave a particular computation logic and it was executed in exactly the same manner that it was supposed to. So that eliminates the entire cycle of having whitelisting or having agents stake their thing. And the whole point of having staking is also from the perspective that if they do not do something which is in the best interest of the network, or they try to manipulate something, or they try to do something that is actually adverse to what was desired, their funds get slashed, right? So that's basically instead of a carrot, it is a stick, right? To make sure that they are in line. Now, because we have removed all of that mechanism, now you can imagine like there is faster adoption because people can randomly come and they can execute it because the entire trust factor has gone to the enclaves. There are a lot less people who are required to take a cut out of it, as in like a validator also gets paid because they are doing this activity. So you are saving that cost. That again gets redistributed back to the client and the person who is executing it. So that reduces the cost of executing that job. There is no place where it can be to dispute because it is a single place where the execution is happening. It's not like 10 people are executing it and then they're comparing notes. So again, that reduces the disputes. So these all mechanisms make it, and since it is a single entity, there is no consensus, there is no validations, and then there is no disputes. So that overall reduces the overall cost of executing that particular transaction, right? So in short, the entire thing becomes a lot faster, cheaper, and much more secure.
Okay.
So this is basically the challenge with the other ones where that they are failing to scale up because that hinders their scalability.
Hmm. Interesting. Is it fair to say that you are in the custom triggers type of thing for Web3? Like custom jobs that trigger by upon some sort of triggers, right? By some sort of
triggers
requirements.
Is just one part of it, right? Triggers is not necessarily only... sure, why not? It's intent. Basically, we are... Intent. These are all intent networks, right? So Powerpool, Gelato, we are all in the space of intent networks. We are all about executing the thing. Like keeper network by its definition are like, these are keepers, like who are agents who will execute your job for a fee. We are the same thing. We are also executing any job that you require of us for a fee. But our approach and architecture makes us much more better in terms of executing certain very niche use cases. And while in terms of comparison, in terms of speed and cost, it makes it a lot easier for us to do it.
Yeah, interesting. Could you walk us like how it actually work with the technology?
Sure. So if I have to talk about like very high level, right? So there are four steps that we have simplified it down to, right? So first is basically you as a come as a client onto the platform. There are two options that you can execute a job. Now, we have tried to cater to, as I said, both laymen and very hardcore technical developers, right? So the option one is where people can experiment. They can use AI to build their intent. And the AI will create that code for you in the backend. On the other side, there are very big enterprises, very mission critical jobs. They are not looking for experimentation. All they require is a very trustworthy standard process for executing their jobs, right? So they get a method in terms of uploading their custom jobs, right? They have already built a job. They just want us to execute it. Fair enough. Now, please understand these jobs can also be very, very proprietary algorithms also, right? You don't want the rest of the world to even know what that algorithm is about. You can have a very, very strong arbitrage algorithm, which is a very big secret. Why not? You can execute it. And no one needs to be any wiser, right? So you build that code and upload it. And for running that code, for each iteration of run, you allocate a reward to it. Like, for this job, I think it is going to be worth, I'm willing to pay 5 cents for it, say for example. Okay. So with these two inputs, the code and the rewards, it goes to a smart contract where we validate it, we basically execute it, and we basically package it to make it accessible on our marketplace. And it is published. Now, on the other side of the spectrum are agents. Agents are the entities who are actually going to host that particular, as I said, the CPU or TEs, and will set it up that, okay, they can accept a job, execute it, publish the response, and in return for that service, they are going to get paid. Now, as an analogy, you can think of it like they can be doing something like hosting a network cloud. You give them a job, for example, hosting a website for a minute, they will create a AWS account, they will create a server, they will host the website for a minute, they will process the job, give you the response, and then they will close down that server, right? But for hosting that server, the hardware, those cost money, right? So they are also incurring a cost. They get paid through this reward. And as I earlier gave an example of 5 cents for a job, is this sufficient enough for executing the job and yet making a commission on top of it? definitely, if that works for them, they will pick up the job. If it is too low, if it is not enough to pay the gas fees, not enough for the jobs to be executed, the cost of the hosting of the teams, they will not pick it up. So that is an indication back to the clients that they need to increase the cost. But it should not be that heavy, high, that agents, basically it's a pure open marketplace to decide on the pricing. Now, once that particular agreement is made, that
is particular pricing price, determined by supply and demand? Or how is
yes, it is open market pricing. Hmm. So if it is too low, it will not get picked up. If it is too high, basically the client can keep increasing it in iterations. So the minimum price that an agent can run it for a profit, they will run it. So basically that forces the agents to be also as efficient as possible, right? Because that forces them to down to be as efficient, as optimal as possible, like in order to incur the least cost and thus able to generate a profit even with the smallest of the margins.
Hmm. Okay.
So it works both ways.
I see. Yeah. Going back to the option one over there, right? Use AI prompt. I mean, one of the things we've seen with generative AI or large language model, that what happened if it's an invalid prompt or invalid, you know, input from the user and it doesn't generate the correct code?
I will explain
how we handle that.
Sure. So I'll explain that. So, okay, let me explain you with the scenario that for a TEE or enclave, there are only two possible outcomes: that did it run or did it not run? There is no intermediate. Now, when I say it ran or it did not run, is like it successfully completed all the steps that were indicated in the job. If it completed it successfully, go ahead. That is a success for it. Now, one of the steps, say for example, is to go and fetch a particular data from a website. And it just so happens that website is down at that instant. So our data is not able to be fetched back from that particular website. But from the scope of the agent, he did make the request. The job did go to that website and make that request. The response was a null. That's fair enough. But that null is also a valid response for me, because I am getting paid, an agent is getting paid just for executing the job on the TEE. So he needs to be paid for the TEE. If the job is bad, if the job is not able to be fulfilled properly, but I can prove that yes, I did try to execute it and it did not return a good value, that is not the fault of the agent. So the cost has to be borne by the client.
Oh, so that's very clear cut whether it run or didn't run.
Yeah. So as far as the TEE is concerned, there is no dispute. That's what I earlier mentioned, like TEEs don't have a dispute. They will run. The job response might not be optimal as per your expectation. That's fair enough. If you write a bad code and you ask me to run it, I will run it. I'll charge you for it. But if it is not something that is useful to you, that is your fault.
I see. But then don't you think that it would discourage users though? If they don't get what they want?
It actually increases experimentations, right?
But don't user or clients have to pay more?
No.
For another request?
That gives them an instant response that instead of waiting for 2 weeks to build a job, you are immediately able to test it out, right? So that can be a huge testing tool for them. Hmm. And that these runs are hardly like a 1 cent or 2 cents each run.
I see.
It depends on the network and the gas price. Again, I'm not trying to generalize it, but again, this is typically how you can quickly create something, run it, check it out for a fraction of a cost. From end to end, it will hardly take you within a couple of hours to complete the entire cycle.
Do you build your own model for this, AI model that handles this, or did you use?
No, so basically there are two parts to it, module. So we have dedicated LLMs, or basically AI modules, to create this code. We are not tampering, or basically we don't have a feedback loop to improve on that, right? So those are industry standards that are out there. What we have done is we are actually created our own module to iterate or generate better prompts for the user. So basically, we are helping people to provide better prompts to the AI module. So that has become an iterative cycle for us. So if you give a good input, it will give you a better job. And if a job is, well, again, if you give a bad input and a bad job is created, and you tell it back like, okay, this did not work as per your requirement, we will change the prompt. We will ask you to change the prompt.
Okay, so basically you get the user feedback, right?
Yes.
Probably give like a thumbs up, thumbs down, and then, okay.
Yes.
Hmm.
So basically, we had to take that analysis is because of the cost factor. Because if we could have tried to create our own model for the code itself, but that would have run us into a couple of thousands of dollars every month.
Yeah, it's very expensive. Yeah.
So basically, we decided not to get into that space. We basically, again, please understand, like, the way that the technology is improving, right? Even the code that we are right now using, it's really good. But I am very sure 6 months down the line, it will be at least 20 times much better. So I'm not an expert in that. Let me not work on that. I'll rather have someone work on it, and I'll rather have that module get better inputs from my customers, which is specific to our platform. I don't want a person to come to my platform and say, like, okay, please help me create a cat sipping a juice on the beach, right? Photograph. So I don't want that kind of a job to be created on my platform.
I see. But how would you like censor that job on the platform?
I don't need to. They can give that. I basically, the job that is going to be created, it will get encoded in an image file, right? That executable file. If he's willing to give me money, I'll execute it. If it returns you crap, you lost the money, right? Every input that you have given, you have to associate a reward with it. So you are paying money for it.
I see.
Even though it is 1 cent,
yeah,
but
you're
still paying for it.
Okay. And do they pay in crypto, fiat? Do they have to front load it? And how does it work?
Okay, so basically, that is part of tokens, that structure that we are working out, as in, like, we are planning on launching our own tokens, which will basically be the choice of currency for us to create a job and award the agents for that. And with that said, they have to purchase the tokens upfront before they can use it. But again, that is something that is still in the works. So we are still working things out there. So those things are something that will take us some more time to give out a better clarity around.
Okay, I see. Yeah, very interesting.
But overall, that is the structure that we are talking about, that it will be run through our own tokens.
Okay, so both the clients and agent have to purchase a token?
Yes.
For it to work?
So the idea here is, and again, quickly talk about the insured jobs here, where it is, this is the specific type of jobs that where we take a guarantee, like, okay, if they are simple jobs, they are predetermined, like, what is the activity, and 90% of them are going to be predetermined, because, as I said, like, a lot of enterprise customers are looking for stability and reliability, right? So their jobs are also going to be not like varying in complexities every day. It will be a standard job that they want to be executed on a regular basis. As long as it matches our certain criteria, there are certain agents that are going to run it. And that means only one agent gets assigned in a undeterministic manner, that, okay, that agent is allocated that slot of time to execute it. So that prevents other people from competing against him, right? So he has that dedicated slot. In case he doesn't do it, and in order to participate in these ensure jobs, he has to stake it, right? So if he's not able to execute it, the job gets passed on to the second agent in line, and the first agent's tokens are getting slashed. Part of which will get back to the client, and part of it will be also be part of the reward for the second agent. So that's how the entire cycle will continue. So for those specific ones, we are also talking about staking with our tokens. But on the other side, we have on-demand jobs where even proprietary algorithms, as complex algorithms as you want, we are also thinking of actually having AI modules that people can come and run it. They can run it as a ZK proofs also if they want to do it. So they can define any kind of a job, give it to us, like, okay, I want a ZK proof. Okay, fair enough. We'll execute it for you. Those come into an on-demand job where it is competition-based. Like, it can be a little costly, but you have a guarantee, like, okay, hundreds and thousands of agents are going to compete against each other to execute the job for you. And whoever does it first gets to earn the reward. So that's how the entire cycle works. So as you can imagine, like, the token is heavily integrated in each step of the process.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense. So since this is a marketplace, right, two-sided, then
yes.
Which side is more important for you in the beginning?
So basically, we have agents right now. So right now, our focus is around clients and getting that ecosystem established. But again, that is the right now state that we are talking about. It is not based on any priority or any importance, but it is just that we are at the stage where we are looking at other clients to come on board, DApps, protocols, and everything to come on board, and then be available to ask for jobs. Once the jobs come into play, the agents are going to execute it for them and earn rewards. So after a point of time, it will become a balancing thing.
I see. Makes sense. Are you
as of now? It is just we are right now focused on clients, but agents are already available on our platform.
Got it. So you like provide the agent, is that right? In a way, or we have it run already.
We have people who have volunteered to be agents.
I see.
This is a voluntary job. Basically, if you want to earn money today, you can come onto a platform. Host up, like, given the same analogy, you can host a AWS cloud instant, run the job, get rewarded, get paid.
Okay. And I guess the, well, the not tokenomic, but the business case for the agent must work out, right?
Because they have to decide
run things on.
They have to do it. Yeah. So that is up to them to decide upon the cost and the amount of profit that they want to earn. Okay, so basically, let me put it this way, right? If it is, if I want to have a 50% profit margin, of course, there will be someone else who will undercut you. If you're waiting for the price of the job to go up to a certain point, there will be always someone else who will be much more eager to earn even 49 cents. Even 49% profit margin is good enough for him. So basically, that undercuts him to increase the competition for them. But on the other side, insured jobs, if they stake it, they get assured rewards as long as they run it.
Okay.
There's no competition. They just have to run it within the time span.
I see.
So
interesting.
They have higher chances of profit there as well. For higher staking, so higher rewards also.
Okay. And what phase of your project are you in right now?
We have completed the MVP. So basically, this entire thing is right now working from the custom job creation, the job assignment, and the on-demand part, and giving you the end result. The rewards part, as I said, the tokenomics we are still working out. So the rewards part we have kind of set aside. So it is something that we are paying for the agents right now, but again, it is a free service for everyone. And that particular route is currently available and running in a couple of testnets.
Cool. When you said testnet, are we talking like some Ethereum testnet
Yes, so we are right now talking about EVM chains. We have a couple of tie-ups with a few protocols as we are talking, and then they are showing an interest and we are deploying this entire system onto their platform. So one more interesting part of it is, again, this is not prominent in this particular image, but is that we are also trying to say, for example, is the clients can be sitting on one protocol. Say, for example, Polygon. And agents can be sitting on a different protocol. Say, Arbitrum. Clients can initiate their request in Polygon. The job request will come onto the Arbitrum. The agents will execute it on Arbitrum. The feed will go back to the Polygon.
Okay.
So when you are thinking about this, you can think of all the L1, L2s, L3s across the board.
Mm. Okay. So they can basically go on any chain and make this happen.
Yeah. So that basically means that you don't need to come to Polygon. A Polygon user has to come to Arbitrum to execute their jobs. No.
Mm. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
But again, so when, the cost of bridging and all, the gas price, the activities, those things under, we basically take care of the entire abstraction of that complexity. But in return, the cost of executing and the rewards will have to be also correspondingly valuable for agents to execute it. So it's always a balancing act, but it is determined by the market. It's not something that we are controlling it in any manner. We don't want to control it in any manner.
I see. Yeah. So if it's too expensive, then it probably will not be executed, right?
No, if it is too expensive, as in like, for agents, yes.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah.
So that itself is an indication back to the users and clients that this is not sufficient enough. Because their focus will be to bring the price down as much as possible, right? They want to run it as cheap as possible. But if they give us like that a job that requires us to hop across like 10 different protocols before we can execute it, you have to be willing to pay for it also, right? No one will run it for a loss.
Yeah. When you say bring the price down, what sort of the Oracle price?
Not Oracle price. Basically, I as a client, if I want to run my job, I want to run it as cheap manner as possible. I want to reduce my rewards allocation as much as possible. Like if I am supposed to pay $1, I'll pay 90 cents or 80 cents or 70 cents or 50 cents even.
They want to
bring the price down of the job.
No.
And the agents want to increase the price as much as normal. So that is a regular market dynamics.
Is there a market price for some of these jobs already?
Or are you
planning to create the market, right? So you're going to create the market.
So this will be a jobs marketplace. Basically, we can give a feedback loop in terms of if it is not getting picked up beyond a certain point of time, then we can go back to the clients and give them a feedback that, yes, this is not getting picked up because we assume that the price is too low. So we can have that feedback loop. But it's for the clients to decide. If they don't want to increase it, the job will just keep on sitting there.
Okay. Makes sense, yeah. Is there any other slides in here you want to share?
So this is more or less the overall picture that we wanted as a Oracle and Bridges. This is exactly what I was talking about earlier in terms of different technologies and how they are using it, right? So it's always a balancing act between number of nodes that are active, number of validators. So the higher number of validators means more security, but then higher number of nodes meaning higher cost also. So it's always a balancing act between a cost and the security. Some people prefer to be lower cost and lower security. Some prefer like, okay, if I give you higher security, of course you have to be willing to pay for it higher also. So because of our unique architecture approach, we are able to give higher security, not as high as the completely decentralized one, but very, very close to it. And for a almost 1/10 of the fraction of a cost.
I see.
So this basically gives you an idea about the different protocols, oracles, bridges, and where they stand with respect to the security, cost, because this is the standard discussions across the board. So when we looked at it, we felt like we can do something better by offering something at par security, but a fraction of a cost. We don't need that heavy infrastructure. We don't need that many validators to come on board. We don't need to worry about consensus algorithms or anything. And all that cost savings that I am having, I'm passing it back to my customers and agents.
Okay.
So they are also happy.
I see. And would this be decentralized?
It is decentralized. It's completely decentralized. Because, so agents, as I said, I'll go back to the previous slide. I'm talking now at the part of on-demand. So basically, there can be thousands of people out there who are willing to run your job. You just submit your job. You cannot define who gets to run the job, right? So everyone is competing against each other. You don't know which chip is actually going to actually execute your job, right? Because there are thousands of agents. So there are thousands of different instances of enclaves that are running. So you cannot pick and choose which agent gets to run it, which hardware chip is going to execute your job. And if the more agents come into play, the more decentralized it becomes. So there's no single point of failure. Even if some one agent's enclave fails, that doesn't mean the entire network fails. There is always some other agent with a better hardware, better infrastructure, better chip set who will be able to execute it. So it prevents it from being a single point of failure.
I see. Makes sense.
And in terms of insured jobs, we have an entire array of all the insured agents, one after the other. And their assignment is done indeterministically. So as in like you cannot predetermine as in like who will get to run that job when. But once it is assigned, it is completely assigned for the entire ecosystem. So they know, if my previous person is not able to execute it, I am responsible for executing it. And in return, his funds also getting slashed and will be rewarded to me. So that's even higher benefit for me.
Okay. Makes sense, yeah.
And since this is randomly allocated, so these agents, again, there is no point that if one person again fails, there is always someone behind him to execute the job. So at any cost, the jobs are never compromised. And I'll give you one very funny scenario, right? Now, say, for example, I don't have any agents. Something happens, some regulation happens, something crashes and I'm unable to offer it to my agents. Even in that scenario, the clients, so we are also trying to have specific tooling for our agents to be able to automate these running of these enclaves and running of the jobs also, right? So even the clients can also become an agent overnight. Like they can become an on-demand overnight agent and can execute their own job if they feel like. If there is no one in the system, they themselves can come and execute it. But what that means is their end, they always get their result. Their entire business doesn't stop just because I fail to be able to provide it to them. So they become way self-sustained as possible.
Did that
make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Anyway, let's talk about the human side of this company of yours. You can quit sharing your screen if you finish already. How many people right now in your company?
So we are a total of 5 people. Some of them are working on a part-time capacity, but they are dedicated to this project. Again, as I said, like we are right now in couple of funding rounds. To make it established, we are right now talking to a couple of testnets to build the ecosystem, build the traction and such. And that is something that we are planning for this and next quarter. So that's where we are. So given the kind of heavy cost involved and the structure of the projects involved, we are kind of taking it on a day-by-day basis in terms of there are 3 people who are full-time working on it. But rest of the team, I have like 3 or 4 people who are lined up. but working partly till we get the next round of funding.
I see. And then you plan to do fundraising sometime this year, right?
So right now, looking at fundraising events, right? Yeah. So okay. Basically, we are planning on having a launch hopefully by second or third quarter this year. And in order to launch it to mainnet, we basically need to take care of a lot of other activity prerequisites, right? Like, for example, doing a smart contract audit, for example. That itself will run us a couple of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And given the fact that we are trying to make it for critical business applications also, we would prefer at least two or three different audits, preferably. Yeah. Second part would be like even launching our tokens on any exchange basically will cost us money. So there are a lot of costly affairs that we can also already foresee, which are even beyond our internal need.
No.
Right? I don't need to pay my staff a salary. I have a runway for that. But in order to cover these external factors and external costs, there are something that I'm looking at fundraising before I can even launch my token.
I see. What are the challenges with your company at the moment? Anything technical? Anything?
So basically, technical challenges are always there. We are trying to be very optimistic as well as we are trying to be as ahead of the curve as possible, given the fact that we are trying to make it possible for people to go wild with their requirements. So we are even trying to things like how do we bridge Bitcoin with Ethereum, right? As I said, because Bitcoin by its core functionality, it is not designed to be programmable, right? So how do you bring programmability into it? If I'm able to crack that code, that would be a huge thing, right? So we are trying to explore those avenues. So there are technical challenges, no doubt about that. But besides those technical challenges, there are a lot other challenges that are basically things that I'm struggling with are specifically around community management, community building, legal, and financials. So basically, finance and legal go a little hand in hand in terms of understanding where do we go for it. Because those are things that are actually relatively new for even for me. So I'm looking for a couple of advisors and all. I'm reaching out to people well established in the industry to get me some help in terms of helping me understand how do I set up the company, how do I manage my tokenomics, splits, negotiate with the investors. So those are things that I'm actually looking at. Because even though with my stint in corporate side, the negotiations in the corporate is way different from what I am having in the Web3 space, right? So that's basically a couple of factors where I am looking to plug my holes.
I see. Yeah, you mentioned a very important topic in Web3, for any Web3 company. It's community building and community management. How do you plan to build a community? How do you plan to tackle that?
Like I said, I'm not a very expert in that. But again, the whole point of it is there are a couple of strategies that we have devised. The usual ones like airdrops, and yes, those are something that will definitely be something that we'll be looking at and exploring and evaluating. But for that, again, the prerequisite is actually to have our tokens in place and tokenomics in place. But again, assuming that also is wrapped up within a couple of months, we are looking at standard ones. We are also trying to go to a lot of events, webinars, conferences, presenting our solutions, as well as discussing, getting feedback from industry leaders to understand what is going on. These kinds of podcasts definitely help. Thank you, Lam, for doing this.
It
helps us. Yeah, it helps us get the word out, because at the end of the day, we are looking at making it more accessible and more useful, usable for people, right? So if I'm able to make that happen, that would be a really good thing. And then one of the biggest thing that I felt that would help us boost our adoption would be our approach towards the ease of experimentation, which is the use of AI, right? Because we are trying to make it a lot more fun also, right? As in, like, you don't need to be very geeky about how do you approach this Web3, right? You just want to explore about it. People are now talking about the next billion. How do I get the next billion onto the Web3 space and everything? I just say I'll take one user at a time. We'll see where it goes. right? So every experience we will learn, we will grow. And as again, I'm taking the inspirations from other tooling, like generative tooling, like ChatGPT, Midjourney, and all, to see if I can grab the experimentation part of it, making it a lot more fun without the complexity of it. So I'm abstracting all the complexity part of it, the high-end technology part of it and everything, to make it a lot more experimentation. But once we are able to establish our reputation in the market that, yes, we are not only for experimentation, but also for serious business, we also have avenues for that. So we are experimenting to that. But again, I want to build a community that will stand with me and say, like, yes, we know what we are doing. So a couple of things, but again, nothing very specific. I cannot give you a pointer in terms of which one will work or which one will not. It is an experimentation approach that I am going with in terms of, let's try this. Okay, I heard someone doing this kind of a thing. Let's try that.
Yeah, I think an experimentation mindset is definitely necessary in building a Web3 startup. You also mentioned a very interesting point about the next billion users. So I have to ask that. Also, one of my show signature questions is how can we as builders, right? Yeah, what can we do to onboard a billion people into Web3?
Make it as easy as possible for people to use. If it is damn easy that even my grandma can use it, definitely, why not?
Okay, so are you referring to like the user experience, right?
Not user experience itself, right? User experience is one part of it. I mean, people confuse the user experience with abstraction, right? Basically, I'm looking at, okay, I'll give you a very small numbers scenario here. Where, again, given the fact that I'm coming from the corporate, I know the volume of money that is there in the Web2 space as compared to Web3. Web3 is just a point in the entire ocean as compared to the rest of the ecosystem, right? So I'm, in order for any people, and trust me, the people who are even trading in Web3, right? I have hundreds of friends who say like they're crypto traders, they do all kinds of farming and staking and everything. But if I go and ask them what is the technical aspects of it, they don't know about it. They don't care actually. All they want is like, okay, I want to do this. So I'm sitting here, I want to trade, I want to buy, okay. I'll take another example, right? We had this BTC ETF a few days back.
Yeah.
Huge hype. Say, for example, I overnight come to hear about it for the first time. I know that it is a huge potential, but how do I leverage it? Do I then go to a developer and then try to get some things, do a KYC, do all of that? Or I just come to my platform, put a request, okay, I want to do this. It is done within an hour. You are able to track on the trends immediately, which are rapidly coming and rapidly going. Sure, why not? Well, people want that. It is basically not about... See, there are very, very small portion of people who are very technical. Few thousands. I can, even though there's huge majority, this is the level of depth of the technology that is right now out in the world. Very few people actually know in and out of it. They know something. I'm not saying they don't know anything. There's a huge bunch of people who can do a smart coding. But if I ask them very, very specific questions about very specific protocols in the other end of the world, very high chance that they'll not know it. And that is the state of the people who are calling them technologists. And a trader, a person who is interested in the business part of it, it is a very different story altogether, right, for them. They don't care at all about the technology. As long as they can leverage the best of the technologies, they basically defer to us all the complex part of it. We make it simple. We make it nice and happy for them to be able to use it. Give you assurances that it is basically safe for them. Give them complete control, which is the essence of blockchain, that they are not reliant on us at any point of time. Even if we don't exist, it doesn't matter to them. It should not hamper them in any manner. Their work should continue to happen. As long as I can give those assurances in the easy to use manner, I think that is sufficient. It doesn't matter whether it's pink or green or it has beautiful buttons. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about UX part of it. Yes, that is important. I'm not underselling it, but my point here is think of the actual end business goals for people. If I'm able to make that happen for them, people will automatically be able to create some beautiful stuff that I have not even thought about. I just want to be an enabler. I see, at the end of the day, we are an infrastructure provider. We are not DApp, or we are not an entity who is building end customer users. Basically, we'll just enable them to build something better for the tomorrow.
Yeah. Makes sense. Okay. So with being an infrastructure provider, where do you think that how was the infra landscape of Web3 change in the next few years? How will it evolve? What are some things that you see?
Okay. That's a very, very interesting question. I don't know how to put it very softly, right? So the point is, like, there are people have been there, like, providing infrastructure for a long time in Web3 space. But a very simple observation I have had is, like, every day they are changing their narrative. They are providing the core structure there. There's nothing that they're changing in terms of the infrastructure or the offering that they have. But their narratives are changing based on the day of the week. Today it says DeepIn, right? DeepIn is, you'll hear, like, DeepIn is very trendy right now. Well, we are also DeepIn, but again, fine, it applies to me. But again, how does it help my narrative? If I'm talking to an investor, yeah, everyone is a DeepIn. Fair enough. Yesterday, everyone was an intent network. Intent network is also picking up very fast now, because now everyone wants to be an intent network. Everyone is intent-centric infrastructure, architecture, everyone. Fair enough. So I feel like infrastructure-wise, people are doing a lot of stuff, but it is not coming out as, like, core infrastructure because it is not trendy enough. People, like, again, if I call myself as a marketplace, people say I'm so 20 or 20. Basically, I'm already old if I call myself as a marketplace. So it's always the infrastructure story becomes very difficult to make it jazzy. But they are very, very crucial if we want to build systems that are going to enable for future players. So while it is not sexy, it changes their narrative, but there is some huge, big potential projects that are happening, which we are really excited about. That, okay, if they come out, things will become very easy for people to build. Like, again, I gave you an example, right? If I'm sitting on one network and I can transact in any network of my choice, I don't mind, without hopping across each other and everything. I don't care whether it has native bridges, I have to hop across 10 platforms before I get to that. Doesn't matter. But if I'm able to make it, why not? I mean, furthermore, if it is a plug and play, tomorrow someone else wakes up and says, like, I have a new protocol, I want to join. Okay, take this whatever plugin and then use it. Why not? So things are happening. They're not sexy, not fun to see or hear about, or people lose interest in them very fast because everyone wants the next jazzy thing, less shiny thing. Because, again, that's their mentality, but fine, fair enough. But there are some very serious people who are investing in it, working towards building it, and some good processes that we are expected to see in the next 6 months.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing the perspective. Yeah, and I think how to be relevant in this day and age, right? You have to be on the trend or create your own trend, I guess. It's a very difficult. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution, right, for that.
Yeah. And see, trends, as I said, right, it is an overnight thing nowadays. It's basically people changing narratives left and right. Today, someone tweets something, picks up, fair enough, that becomes a trend. So how do you stay up to date with the trends? I would rather ask, do you really want to be up to date with the trends? Because the trends in Web3 spaces, people themselves call it fads most of the time, right? It's there, but they don't have a credibility as in why that is there. What is that actually justifies it? Unless you have a real solid reasoning behind a trend, it is just a rumor. How do you differentiate between a rumor and a trend is the question I'm asking. I don't mind being on the cutting edges, right? That's basically what we are trying to do as well. But we have to have our internal filters in terms of, does it actually change something fundamentally or not? If you call me as an intent network, you call me a marketplace, you call me a DeepIn, does it really change what I'm offering? No. Fair enough. If you want to call me a DeepIn, your wish, I'll call myself DeepIn. If that makes you happy, I'll do that. But that doesn't fundamentally changes my approach or business or architecture or anything. Now, if something really happens where we think, like, okay, yes, it has a potential, it adds value to it. Like, for example, Bitcoin. For so many years, it was always something to be holded. It was not something that was programmable. That's why Ethereum picked up, right? Ethereum brought a lot of programmability to the currency. But now things are looking a different way, where can I have the huge liquidity of Bitcoin and make it work along with the programmability of Ethereum? Sure, then it solves the problem for both the sides, right? Bitcoin people are just holding money. They are not able to use it. They are not able to invest it. They are not able to stake in it. They are not going to do a lot of things. The entire lending, borrowing, nothing. There's a lot of challenges with that. On the other side, there's a huge programmability, but the liquidity that Bitcoin holds, there's no way closer to it, right? So basically, both sides wins. Then, yes, it makes sense. It's worth investigating. Keep a lookout for. Yes, sure. But if it is something that's just a narrative, if it is just a, what do I call it? A tag? Maybe not.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Harsh on the front of trends in terms of to decide upon whether it actually is a trend or it is just a passing breeze. I'm pretty harsh on trends in evaluating them.
Yeah, I think we do have to rely on data, right? In this day and age, there's probably data.
And not only data, but you have to do your own self-inspection. My data, what it is applies to me, might be very different from how it is applicable to you. Right? Your business might have a very different architecture, very different approach, where it might make more sense than me. Sure, go ahead. So you have to do a due diligence and self-evaluate whether it is actually something that is that benefits you or not. If yes, why not? Definitely go ahead.
Cool. Yeah, true. That's fine. Just two more questions from my side before we close it out. One is that, do you have any advice for people who want to run their own Web3 company?
The only thing that I know and I have learned across my entire years is be very, very open to experimentation. The reason I'm saying this is because even when I'm running now with Decimal, I got so many feedback from so many people saying, we are not ready yet. Let's not put it into the market. Let's not go out. Let's get to that stage before we go out. And by that time, that something else is always a higher priority. I am really not comfortable that side. So basically, I've always found that, fair enough, at this point of time, nobody knows me in Web3 space. I make a huge blunder. No one bothers. I can afford to take risks. I can afford to go out, embarrass myself. Get feedback. Improve. Feedback. Because again, this space is so dynamic, so rapidly moving, right? It's very difficult to keep up to date otherwise. Because we can't know what is going out, what is relevant, are we on the right track or not, the very next day. So we have to be out there, talk to people, get their opinions every day. And that requires a lot of experimentation. Means I am taking every meeting as a learning. I don't care whether I win or lose. I've talked to like 20 investors so far, but I don't know what is going to happen. They're still evaluating, fair enough. But every meeting that I go, I know for a fact that, yes, I'm learning something new. And for the next investor, I'm doing something better. Same thing with my customers. Same thing with protocols. Same thing with networks. Same thing with the apps. I'm trying to do that every day. And that's the only thing I know how I can remain relevant. I'm an old guy, right?
You don't look old. You look young.
Thank you. But yeah, I mean, in this industry, like, I am one of the very old faces that you'll see. Of course, there are a few which are older. But again, with due respect, this is a young man's game. It's becoming a very, very young man's game. So in order for us to be relevant even furthermore, we have to be very up to our toes. And the only way that I can think of that I can remain relevant and be able to give advices like you are asking me to is by experimentation alone. Otherwise, I don't have any other specific advice for anyone. I'm also learning.
Agree. Yeah, thank you. I think that's a very valuable advice. Yeah, we do have to experiment, get feedback, and then improve and build upon the next iteration, right?
Yeah.
That's the name of the game.
Faster you do, smaller cycles you make, better you do. That's the only thing. Don't be afraid. Nothing happens. No one really remembers you the next day in this world.
No.
Right? So let's not be bothered about what will other people think or anything. Let's go out, do our best, learn, grow.
Yeah.
Someday we'll be there.
Certainly. Yeah, thank you. And then final question, where can people follow you and your company? Feel free to share any social media handles. I will put it in the show notes.
I will do that. I will send it to you separately. I don't have that handy right now. I have shut down a lot of my tabs here just to avoid any distractions. So let me do that and I'll get back to you on that. I'll separately do that.
Oh, good.
But we are available primarily on Telegram, Discord, and Twitter. Again, as I said, we are still like taking it slow. We are still working in a stealth mode. So there's not a lot of activities, but those things are about to change within this quarter. So yeah, look forward to a lot of interactions there.
Awesome. And you have a website, right? I can probably maybe put that in
the
show notes.
Yeah, we have a website, decimal.at. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So that's easy enough. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes for everyone to follow. Once again, Abhijit, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your time today. It's been really fun talking to you today.
Thank you. It was really nice meeting with you and connecting with you. And thanks for this opportunity. I hope it was of some value to you. It was definitely for me, but I hope it's
great.
Helps
it's
you
lot,
also.
A lot of learning. Yeah, a lot of learning. Very fun for me always. Thank you again.
Thanks.
Have a good one.
Thank you. Bye-bye. See you.
And we are back to my studio. What do you guys think about this episode with Abhijit? Please leave your comment below and let us know. And I'll make sure that both I and Abhijit will read and respond to your comment individually. For the next episode, we'll be talking to the team at FIDE Treasury Protocol. FIDE is FYDE, whose mission is to bring stability to the crypto ecosystem through sustainable on-chain treasury and asset management. I know that's confusing. So to keep it simple, it's basically they help Web3 companies diversify their treasuries, giving the protocols with extra yield and liquidity. If you enjoyed this episode, please give a like and subscribe up here. Thank you so much for listening and see you next time.